Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am joined by Connor Orr of the Weekside Podcast. And Connor, there was a lot to be kind of down about this week, a lot of people to pick on, and we will certainly do that on the show. But I'd like to think we're gonna get some optimism in here too, and we're gonna maybe start with the Cleveland Browns and why we should be a little bit pleased with what the Browns are doing right now.
Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit before we started taping, and I grew up as a Browns fan. I've obviously since abandoned that fandom, but kind of always do view moments like this through that lens of the frustrated 11-year-old Connor with his Tim Couch jersey on, who, you know, all of his friends were Eagles fans and Steelers fans, and they all had a lot of success, Giants fans, during the middle school years. So that one playoff game, Kelly Holcomb against the Steelers, remember I invited everybody to my house because, you know, as a fan, you just want that attention for like 30 seconds that your team has actually done something, and they obviously lost that game. But this is probably, if I were a Browns fan, the best I've felt since that moment going into the playoffs, right? You scored 28 points and a half for the first time since the year the Cold War ended, which is pretty phenomenal. They lead the league in points off turnovers. Like, these are all things that really good teams do, and the Browns are doing those things.
And that's the thing, you can, I'm not going to do it this morning, you can poke holes in some things and say, well, this probably isn't sustainable going forward, they probably won't get this rate of takeaways and that sort of thing, but right now they are, obviously they're running the ball very well, they are ahead of schedule every game, they are getting leads and they are keeping leads, and they are therefore getting wins, and that just seems like the kind of thing that we said about teams who played against the Browns in recent years. I mean, they're 3-1, and it's been three pretty solid wins here.
When so there was about 6 minutes to go in the game, and the Cowboys had condensed the lead to 11 yesterday, and then all of a sudden, all that stuff starts happening, right? Baker Mayfield overthrows Odell Beckham. The punter shanks one. And it does get kind of a fortuitous bounce, but it was a bad punt. And then the Cowboys just whip down the field and score on, I think CeeDee Lamb was more open on that fade route than I've ever seen a receiver open on an end zone fade in my life. And then, you know, that is when I think the fandom does kick in just a little bit, and you say, like, oh my God, I've seen this 1,000 times. Like, they're going to lose this game. This is how the Browns lose every game. It's not just it's not just a regular milquetoast Sunday loss. It's a very public, embarrassing, ridiculous kind of loss, and they didn't do it. But I would say 10 times out of 10 in the past, that is a game that they blow spectacularly.
The other nice thing about the Browns yesterday is, look, we saw Odell Beckham Jr., sort of a reminder that he is a difference maker. I mean, obviously, they've been doing so well on the ground, and it's been a lot of, Kevin Stefanski taking some of the Vikings playbook here, and you know, it's a run-based and play-action offense, and Odell just isn't putting up monster numbers. Huge plays yesterday, finishing with the game-clinching 50-yard touchdown run on a play that looked like it had just completely busted.
Yeah, I mean, he was dead to rights in the backfield, but he has so much speed, you know, and his change of direction ability is so good that, you know, he can kind of negate that, right? And it will not go down as a horrendous play call or as a bust on the offensive line's part, however you want to call it. I would say it was a bad play call because I don't know where that guy who got so deep into Cleveland's backfield, where he ended up kind of being blocked in that scheme. I think he was kind of designated to kind of pull him upfield and get him out of the way. But Odell can negate stuff like that. But I keep thinking to myself, and I'm curious kind of your thoughts on this, is like, why doesn't every team, like, why isn't Bill Callahan like the Darrell Revis of offensive line coaches? Like, why isn't he like a year-to-year mercenary that is just holding out for the best salary and going everywhere? Every team that hires him is better, at running the football, like, markedly better. And I would say that, like, that was probably the biggest acquisition that the Browns made this offseason, bar none, because his ability to streamline their running game, like, there were just gaping holes yesterday, and they're gashing people with Kareem Hunt and a third string running back with Nick Chubb out. And, you know, as much as everyone wants to talk about all the other things that are going on in Cleveland, and you're always going to be weighted to do that because of the star power on the roster, I feel like just the fundamental run game aspect of it has gotten so much better than it ever has been in the past.
Offensive line coaches, just in general, it's kind of fascinating to me. Outside of your head coach and your two coordinators there, sorry, special teams coordinators, but the offense coordinator, defense coordinator, offensive line coach is the most important guy on the staff.
No
question. It seems like there are 8 to 10, maybe, and that's probably a stretch, really good ones. And if you have one of them, it's like you just can't let him go. But if there's like a regime change and one of them gets loose, I mean, there should have been, like you said, there should have been like a monster bidding war for Bill Callahan this offseason.
Yeah, and I mean, imagine if Dante Scarnecchia had become available through some sort of, I don't know, intense rift with Bill Belichick at some point. Like, he could be, if a team was desperate enough, and like I'm looking at the Giants, who have a bunch of developmental players that aren't developing, I would pay him more than some teams are paying their head coaches. I mean, it's that important of a position. And yeah, I mean, Bill Callahan, just everywhere he goes, you know, oh wow, what, you know, that offensive line was so great, and Ezekiel Elliott was so great in Dallas. Well, it, you know, has a lot to do with Bill Callahan pulling the strings and organizing that. And, you know, that the same thing in Cleveland. Like, just because you add you know, a free agent and a rookie first round pick doesn't make your offensive line immediately better. It's having someone develop them and teach them how to do stuff. And, you know, that's what we're seeing in Cleveland right now.
Let's talk about what's going wrong with the Cowboys, because there's a lot going wrong with the Cowboys, specifically on the defensive side of the ball right now. This is the part of the show where I make a bunch of excuses for what's going on there, and I'll lay out a couple of numbers here. Cowboys defense has been on the field for right around 34 minutes per game this year, around 71 plays per week. Each of the last 3 weeks, the offense has turned it over three times and sort of put the Cowboys in a bind here. And stepping aside from that, we knew it was going to be a transition to Mike Nolan after all those years under Rod Marinelli and Chris Richard later. But, you know, it's been that sort of Marinelli, you know, sort of fast-flowing, relatively simple run-to-the-ball defense for years and years. And now it's Mike Nolan who's always run some a little more multiple, some a little more complex. And there was going to be a transition. A lot of the issues you are seeing with the run defense are related to tackling people, and that is an issue that went back to last year. The Cowboys did not tackle people who also, you know, had the football at the time, and that was kind of why they had so many struggles late in the year. That said, there is a lack of just basic competence from this unit right now, and I don't know if it gets fixed. You know, everyone's bringing Earl Thomas. Well, Earl Thomas is kind of out there right now for a reason, and I don't think there's really a quick fix to be made to this defense right now.
Yeah, and we knew that offenses, you know, in general, were probably going to start a little bit ahead of the curve this season with the pandemic, with the lack of a preseason, all that kind of stuff. But there are some defenses that just can't get it together, and Dallas is one of them. And, you know, it pains me especially to say this after, you know, writing a little Alden Smith pump-up column on Friday, you know, talking about how good everybody looked there. But, yeah, this is it's just not coming together. It fundamentally just it looks like there are broken aspects of it. And I will say this, in their first three games, there were a lot of dropped interceptions, like almost an abnormal number of dropped interceptions, like if you went back and you looked at every defensive snap. And so I do think that they're, you know, they're going to start to get some of that back, right? I mean, I think that their bad luck in the takeaway category is not sustainable. That said, they're not playing complementary football. They're leaving their defense out, like you said, way too long, and they just don't have the horses to sustain that. You know, this is not as deep of a Cowboys defense as we've seen them have in the past.
Yeah, they're, like you said, Connor, they are on the wrong end of the takeaway giveaway thing over the last 3 weeks. It's 9-1. The one was the DK Metcalf forgetting to run into the end zone, punch through the end zone last week. So those will come. They even if you don't have a ton of talent, they typically come. You usually get a couple, but they're just getting nothing right now. The last thing I want to say here, and look, I don't want to be the guy who sits here and pretends that I am smarter than everyone on the Cowboys staff, because that is nowhere near the truth. I would completely embarrass myself if you asked me to draw up a single player concept for this team right now. But one thing that I can't get my head around it. Undrafted rookie Terrence Steele gets the start at right tackle. Lyle Collins is now out for the season. Tyron Smith was back for this game, but Terrence Steele is starting on the right side. They just left him singled up on Myles Garrett, and there are ways you can help a young right tackle besides sliding protection or chipping a guy. You can get the ball out quicker. I thought the strip sack might have been a case of Dak holding on to the ball too long, and I could not wrap my head around the fact that they just put Terrence Steele out there and were like, okay, yeah, you can handle Myles Garrett, and then they benched him in the first half, and it was just, I don't know what the thinking is, because it's like when we signed you as an undrafted rookie 3 months ago, you said you could handle Myles Garrett one-on-one, but turns out you were like, so get on the bench now. Like, it just seemed absurd, and kind of again, sometimes teams just get out schemes, sometimes the opponent just has a better plan, and they create those matchups. But that didn't seem to be the case. It seemed to be the plan that Terrence Steele was going to handle Myles Garrett one-on-one, and I couldn't believe it.
And it's weird, because Myles Garrett does get that J.J. Watt treatment, right, where he's mm-hmm. allowed to move around and he's allowed to go seek out those favorable matchups and then blow everything up. And, you know, normally that involves kind of picking and choosing and testing. But as a Cowboys team, like, why aren't you challenging him to find those matchups? Why are you putting a big neon sign to the best matchup and saying, hey, come here and just keep coming back here, and don't worry, we're not going to do anything to stop you? Like, it was a very strange thing. And, you know, I guess you could go back to Mike McCarthy's days in Green Bay and, you know, talk about great offensive line coaches. They had great offensive line coaches back then, and they had great offensive linemen, but this is not that team. Dak Prescott doesn't get the ball out as fast. He's a little bit different of a quarterback than Aaron Rodgers, not any worse, just different. And so you have to adjust, and there seemed to be no adjustment made yesterday. And if you just continually invite a guy who's in the running for the defensive MVP award right now into the backfield, it's complete chaos.
All right, Connor, before we move on, I do owe you an apology. I was a little bit distracted during that first segment because I was in the middle of subscribing to the new Weekside podcast feed. Hey-o. featuring Connor Orr and Jenny Vrentis. For those of you who haven't been paying attention to our promotional language over the past couple weeks, we are splitting up the MMQB podcast feed. On this feed you're listening to right now, you will continue to get the Monday show. You will continue to get the MMQB gambling show on Friday. However, the Weekside podcast, again, Connor and Jenny, wonderful show. You all love it. It has its own feed now. Albert Breer has his own feed. You would have thought I would have subscribed to that, you know, maybe after the show when we weren't doing a podcast. But it was important enough that I felt I should do it right now before I forget. And all of you out there should do the same.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gary. And don't think of it, you know, I was telling Jenny this the other day, it's kind of like we're moving into our own place. You know, our parents have kicked us out. We've soaked up enough of the resources of the feed. We are ripe enough, and it's time to go out on our own. It could be great, you know, or it could be a spectacular failure. So either way, subscribe and follow along with us and see what happens. It's not going to be a failure. It's going to be great. We're going to be great.
Find out if it will be horrible is not a bad promo, actually, but the show's gonna be the same show. It's just on a new feed now, so you have to subscribe to the new feed and you just get it in your feed. It's really not a big deal. You know, it sounds like we're doing something seismic here by splitting up the feed. We're really not. We're just making it easier for you all out there to see what shows are coming into your feed now.
That's right. A totally customizable experience. Imagine if cable providers thought this way, right?
it's a skinny bundle or something. I don't know. All right, let's go Sunday night football here. The NFC East leading Philadelphia Eagles now. This was encouraging, and we'll get into why. You know, yeah, they caught some breaks during this game, and quite frankly, maybe they were due for a couple of breaks. But Carson Wentz looked like he looked at the end of last season when they were completely decimated. He had no one to throw to, but he was still sort of patching this together and making it work. Early this season, you know, scattershot is an understatement with the way he was throwing the ball in terms of accuracy. He was good on Sunday night, made plays with his legs. We've been seeing that this year, but there were no just completely meltdown, oh my goodness, what is he doing out there type of throws, and that's a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, and, you know, just kind of sniffing around on what was going on in Philly, I mean, it seemed like the first 3 weeks, whatever the plan was going into the offseason, it just felt like they weren't going all the way there. And, you know, if you want to get to be, you know, a great whatever it is, outside zone team, whatever your kind of core offensive philosophy is there, it seems like they were sort of just tap dancing around the idea of it. They were sprinkling in concepts when really you kind of need to uproot this entire thing and you need to go at it from one direction. And this isn't like Carson Wentz's breakout year where they went 13-3 and, you know, went to the Super Bowl. They're going to kind of have to start from scratch a little bit with no talent right now, no healthy talent right now. You know, everybody's banged up. And so I think it was good that they got this win over the 49ers when they were still beatable, especially when, you know, they gutted the Giants the way that they did. I think that gives them a little bit of confidence moving forward. And I don't know. I mean, I think that Carson Wentz is better than this. I think we all know that he's better than this, but time will tell in terms of what exactly it was. Was it scheme that was bothering him? Was it all the injuries that were bothering him? It's kind of an interesting sort of case study right now.
Yeah, he finds a guy, Travis Fulgham, practice squad guy, sort of bounced around the last year or two out of Old Dominion. He makes a big catch down the left sideline for the go-ahead touchdown. The rugby guy, Jordan Mailata, filling in for Jason Peters, held his own pretty well. And again, it is a... We talk about the Eagles' injuries. The 49ers are just completely... been devastated by injuries on the defensive side of the ball this year. It's not the same pass rush it was a year ago, but it was good enough. It was certainly good enough offensively here for the Eagles at this point. On the other side of the ball, I mean, look, Nick Mullins has done such a nice job just operating this offense when he's had to, you know, going back to 2018 and going back to the action he saw out in East Rutherford this year. But he was a killer in this one. I mean, he had three turnovers. His two interceptions were both devastating. One came in the red zone, and then he threw the late pick six where he just absolutely did not see his own defender sitting under a little comeback route there.
Yeah, and all of a sudden opens the door for the biggest quarterback controversy in football, Mullins versus Beathard. You know, you really got to wonder what's going to happen there. You know, it's phenomenal that this is probably the first time, and Nick Mullins has done a lot of spot duty, right, over the last couple of years, that we're talking about him being a problem when, you know, look at how many, you know, Mitch Trubisky, for example, you know, guys that were drafted number two overall that, you know, kind of had less of a, you know, less of an easy time being outed as a target here. But, you know, I think this is just a bad game, right? And maybe there's enough of a complete package of film on him to be able to make some determinations. And remember, Nick Mullins' first quarterbacks coach and offensive coordinator, Rich Scangarello, is now over in Philly and, you know, probably could have helped them out with the game planning process a little bit there. But yeah, it's one of those things where I still think he's one of the better backups in the league. And just kind of looking at the landscape right now, could probably be effectively starting for one or two teams this year. But, you know, every once in a while, you're going to run into a bad Nick Mullins.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned during the Cowboys segment here, at some point a defense is just going to start getting a couple of takeaways, just get a couple of breaks at some point. Eagles had one takeaway on the year, and it was actually a special teams takeaway. It was a Cooper Kupp fumbled punt return back in week two. The defense had no takeaways going into Sunday night, and they got three, and that is how you win a game in which you are outgained by 150 yards or so on offense. So, you know, no glaring problems for the Eagles offense, and they catch some breaks on defense, and they go out to Santa Clara and get a win. And if they can just sort of tread water until they get a little bit healthier, still hope here.
I mean, they're in first place in the division, and as of this moment right now, they're the only team in the NFC East, just based by virtue of their playoff berth alone, that would not be picking in the top six of the NFL draft right now. So it's a good year for the Eagles to have struggled early and you know, tried to figure their crap out down the line. Unfortunately for them, I think the one thing that is going to bother them throughout the year is that loss to Washington, right? Because that's, you know, this game, this division is going to come down to one or two games, and that's those are the tap-ins on your schedule. Those are the guys that you need to beat.
Let's go down to Tampa, where, I mean, look, Tom Brady looks really good. They lit it up against the Chargers. This was a little bit dicey early on. The Chargers actually, the Chargers never blitz, and they blitzed a couple times early. Opportunistic blitzing here by Gus Bradley. I think that caused some issues for the Bucs as far as protection goes. But this is why it was so encouraging. One, no Chris Godwin, so you're working without, you know, sort of your 1A receiver here. But on top of that, look, we have seen the Chargers pass rush and just the four-man pass rush, the Bosa, Ingram, Jerry Tillery's had a really nice year there. We've seen them take over games. We saw them almost completely wreck that Chiefs offense in a near upset earlier. The Bucs held up protection-wise when it was a four-man pass rush for the most part, and if they're going to hold up protection-wise, it looks like that Brady receiver rapport is... It's working now. It looks like they are ready to just put up numbers here, and we know the defense is good. So I don't know. Bucks Chiefs Super Bowl is what's going to happen. And if you know, if everyone wants to just sort of take some time off and not watch football between now and February 7th, I mean that's where we're headed toward. Sorry to spoil it.
I'm just curious. You know, I'm going to do a little bit of Googling here. The Tampa Bay Rays and the Yankees start tonight as we tape this podcast. And so there's a chance that as an infantile and sort of largely irrelevant sports town, Tampa Bay could sweep the major championships during the pandemic, which would be kind of hilarious, right? Like, nobody is allowed to celebrate publicly, and you win the Stanley Cup, the World Series, and the Super Bowl. In a matter of like 3 months, and nobody cares, and nobody's allowed to celebrate. That would be amazing.
The new Boston. Yeah, it's the sports nexus of the universe right now, I guess.
Titletown, former excellent, wonderful MMQB editor Bett Marston was really enjoying the Lightning victory when I caught up with her recently, but have not talked to her yet about my Tampa Bay theory in general, that all of their success might be funneled into arguably the darkest year of our history in the last, like, since a very long time ago.
Oh, it's some monkey's paw type stuff going on with Tampa, I guess. Other side of the ball here, look, the Bucks, they just look really good, and I think that's going to be the storyline with them when we talk about them every week. But the other thing from this game, Justin Herbert was fantastic in this game. They are attacking downfield. It's big plays. He is under constant pressure, but he just delivered big play after big play and sort of went shot for shot with Brady in this one. And again, I didn't think there was any realistic chance they were going back to Tyrod. I do very much highlight the fact that Anthony Lynn would use quotes like, when Tyrod is 100% healthy, because there's a lot of
100% healthy.
Yes, there's a lot of leeway with 100%. He could have a hangnail. He could have the sniffles and you know, put it back out there. But at this point, I mean, not only is it Justin Herbert's job, I realize the guy's 0-3 in the QB wins department, but he is he is far ahead of where I think anyone thought he would be. Even the most optimistic projections of where people thought he would be in the first quarter of his rookie season.
And this is what really just chaps my you-know-what about the Chargers is 50% of his throws are coming on 2nd and 7+ or 3rd and 7+, right? You have to pepper in early down throws and allow him to take his shots. They're being so obvious and they're telegraphing their plays. This is a pro style ideology when they have all this talent, and you know, especially yesterday. So I was looking up one of my favorite stats for quarterbacks is completion percentage above expectations. So they have mm-hmm. their actual completion percentage, what it should be, and then your plus or minus differential. Justin Herbert is one of the best in football right now. You know, he's behind Russell Wilson, Derek Carr, Joe Burrow, and Gardner Minshew as guys who are completing way more passes than they should. Keenan Allen was a monster yesterday. Like, pepper in some early down throws. Make yourself harder to defend. This is a really, really good Buccaneers defense, and you were scoring on them, you know, and it bothers me that they're still babying him like a rookie when at this point he's already shown you that he's ahead of the curve, so let's accelerate. I mean, this is what the Bengals are doing with Joe Burrow. They've kind of just, you know, they're like, okay, we're not running RPOs like you ran at LSU. We're just gonna gun this thing, and I think that that's what the Chargers need to do with Justin Herbert. That was a winnable game yesterday. Like, they should have won that game. But instead, it's like, okay, let's run on first down and then try to get half the distance on second down and then convert on third down and survive. But you don't need to do that. That's why you draft a quarterback in the top 10, because he's going to be a guy that negates that typical thought process.
And you could kind of you could make the argument like, well, if our running game is cooking, let's stick with it on first down. I mean, they were, I'm looking at the numbers here, 18 carries, 32 yards for non-Justin Herbert rushing attempts yesterday. So they had nothing in the run game. They did not protect Herbert well, and he's still, in spite of all that, just putting up monster performances here.
Free Justin Herbert.
Ah, you know it. Make up the t-shirts right now. Start the hashtag. All right, let's go out to Chicago for Nick Foles' first start against the Colts, and he was not Mitch Trubisky erratic out there, but he was not accurate. He did not look comfortable with his receivers. You wonder if the Bears should have perhaps anticipated this inevitability and given Foles more first-team snaps over the course of the summer, and maybe you get rid of some of these growing pains, or, you know, maybe it's not growing pains. Maybe this is just the reality for a Nick Foles-led offense going forward here.
Yeah, 26 of 42, 249, a total QBR rating of 42.5. It's just, I don't know. It's ugly football, but nobody's helping, right? I mean, you know, David Montgomery is getting 2.7 yards a carry. You're basically just hoping that Foles and Allen Robinson can figure this thing out together, and it's just not effective, right? And then you look at the other side of the ball, even though the Colts are only scoring 19 points, they have so many options. I mean, Jonathan Taylor might finish the season, you know, as a top five running back, and then, you know, he's spreading the ball around, you know, and he's doing a really good job of that as some sort of like autoplay Buffalo Wild Wings video blast from my computer for no reason. But, you know, they're just so one-dimensional. And it was surprising to me that if you're Matt Nagy, you know that going in, that your team just kind of leans so heavily in one direction and depends so heavily on a few things, that, like, why obliterate any remaining confidence that you have in your rookie starter to not get a market improvement at quarterback, right? Like, this is at best like a replacement level swap right now, and I don't think that makes your team any better. And with Trubisky, at least you get that mobility aspect. You can probably work out some ways to get them to move the ball a little bit better. But yeah, I think this is the start of Chicago's not free fall, but, you know, fall back to a record that makes some sense for their roster.
Yeah, and look, if we go back up to 2018, Matt Nagy's system is really good. When Trubisky had that had the Pro Bowl year in 2018, if you go over the tape, there were still so many just wide open receivers that sort of, you know, whether he overshot them or missed them, there were so many plays left out on the field, and it was kind of like, wow, if this thing operates, if you have a quarterback operating it the way it should be operated, this might be a potentially really good offense. You didn't really, and I'm not saying Nick Foles is the guy to do that, but you didn't see that kind of offense yesterday. As far as Foles go, you didn't really see anything. You know, they didn't use a ton of play action. They didn't use a ton of RPO stuff. It just kind of looked like, okay, we're going to just kind of hang around here. We're going to try and hit some deep shots every now and then, but we're going to just try and hang around in this game, and hopefully Phillip Rivers throws a couple of interceptions. And it was almost like the formula of we saw how Jacksonville beat the Colts, and it was Phillip Rivers throwing bonehead interceptions. And if we can just get a couple of those, we'll win this game. Otherwise, we're just going to not. Like, I don't know what the approach was.
I'm surprised at how, you know, like you said, offenses that seem so hyper-modern just – and maybe it's because we get acclimated to the more exciting aspects of it. So after a few years, it's not exciting or whatever it is. But I mean, I thought this too, when you brought up Matt Nagy's first year, it reminded me of Chip Kelly's first year in the frequency of wide open receivers, you know, just like, oh my mm-hmm. God, how like this system at the time could have turned anybody. And I'm, you know, Nick Foles, Mark Sanchez, Michael Vick into like world-beating quarterbacks as long as you could hit the broadside of a barn. And I think that, you know, I'm just wondering like how that goes away so quickly when Andy Reid's still doing it, right? It's been, you know, however long he's been in Kansas City, and it seems like the frequency of open receivers is even better every year that he does this, whereas like some of these other guys, it's like it just compresses a little bit and it gets less and less so over time. But I don't know. I mean, is Chicago just sort of trying to play to their strengths and just, you know, keep the defense off the field a little longer and they're getting a little more conventional, or has it really lost its kind of that sparkly aspect of it? I think it has.
Yeah, it's it feels like they're trying to recapture that 2018 magic, and frankly, I don't think that type of magic can be recaptured. They were fueled by takeaways in 2018, and I don't think you can sit here and say we are going to take the ball away 35 to 40 times this year and that's how we're going to win. I just don't think that's a strategy. I mean, granted, they took it away from the last couple opponents, but it's not something you can bank on a week-to-week basis, and certainly not something you can bank on in January. Yeah, I mean, four takeaways over four games here for this defense. It's just not going to be what it was in 2018, so you got to come up with something offensively. And again, I don't think the answers are on this roster, is what we'll ultimately find out as the year goes on. I will say, though, Matt Eberflus' bandwagon is rolling again. That Colts defense looks utterly dominant, and I know they haven't played some world beaters the last couple of weeks, but we're seeing what offenses are doing across the NFL, where just no one's tackling and everyone's getting a million points, and they've given up 29 points over the last 3 weeks, and 16 of those points came in absolute garbage time. So really, in meaningful football, they are just completely shutting down opponents right now.
Yeah, I would say Colts fans, enjoy him while you can, in working up our head coaching short list, at least for right now in September. And obviously, a lot of that stuff ebbs and flows with the success of the team. But Eberflus was at the top of many, many people's lists in terms of like, this guy's going to go pretty quickly. So enjoy it while you still can.
All right, Connor, get out of here for a second. It is time for the SI Fantasy segment presented by DraftKings. I'm now joined by Michael Fabiano of the SI Fantasy Podcast and SI.com/fantasy. Before we jump into the early waiver wire for week 5, we got to talk a little Davante Adams at the top here for those of you listening on Monday going into Monday Night Football.
Yeah, and Davante, it was good enough to tweet out that he's not playing tonight. I wish more players would do that. I guess probably teams frown on that, but he tweeted out that he's not going to be able to play. So if you're in trouble with Adams in your lineup, if you moved him to flex, which you should have, Robert Tonyan's probably the best option to go get off the waiver wire, start him over Adams. If you kept him at wide receiver, the options are very limited. I would say Demarcus Robinson, Damir Byrd, because Kansas City and New England are playing also tonight. Darius Shepherd, and that assumes that a guy like N'Keal Harry is not available in most leagues.
Yeah, I was going to say, Davante Adams, good man. It's been a trying week for fantasy managers everywhere, so we appreciate it, buddy. Well, let's get into the early waiver wire for week five here. We'll start off with the running backs, I guess. We have traditional bye weeks coming up here in week five starting, even though we sort of got surprised in week four.
Right, and running backs getting thin, like very thin. So the big news is that Austin Eckler got hurt and Nick Chubb got hurt. So in LA, Joshua Kelly has to be owned in all leagues. Like, he's already gone in all of my leagues. But if you're in a home league, he could be out there. Gotta own him. He's gotta be 100% owned right now. Justin Jackson also in LA should be owned across the board now, because the Chargers have liked to use two running backs, right? It was Eckler and Kelly. Now it's gonna be Kelly and Jackson. So Jackson needs to be owned. D'Ernest Johnson had a good game against the Cowboys yesterday, although I would argue that Ernest Byner probably could have come out of retirement and rushed for 100 yards, because my Cowboys defense stinks and it's disgusting and it makes me sick. But he's worth an ad off the waiver wire in case Chubb is going to be out for a long period of time. Chase Edmonds has been better than Kenyon Drake. Kenyon Drake has got the bust label written all over him right now. Right now, we hate the Drake. Pick Chase Edmonds up. And then look at what's going on in Carolina. Like, Christian McCaffrey's great and all. Mike Davis has been every bit as good. Okay. He's been tremendous. And if anything happens to Mike Davis, Reggie Bonifant is the next guy up. And yesterday, Bonifant had 12 touches, a touchdown, over 15 fantasy points. So he is a must add as a handcuff for owners who have Mike Davis, because, you know, we've got COVID and injuries all over the place. You can never be too safe.
I feel like every time I bring you in here, it just turns into a semi-roast about your Cowboys defense here. So,
oh, my God. It's so disgusting. I can't stand it, man. It's just sickening. And the team that's in first place is 1-2-1.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's awful. I don't know what they're waiting for. Earl Thomas has got stink on him, obviously, because no one wants anything to do with him. Even the Cowboys, but he's not going to solve the problem. They're just terrible.
NFC East life. Let's go receivers here. Who we got?
More options, more good options. Tim Patrick, who had a very good game on Thursday night against the Jets, 7 targets, 6 catches, over 23 fantasy points. The Broncos are without Cortland Sutton. KJ Hamler's banged up as well, so Tim Patrick's worth a look. T. Higgins, AJ Green, where have you gone? I mean, he's on a milk carton, man. Higgins, over the last 2 weeks, 16 targets, 9 catches, 2 touchdowns. AJ Green's on the outside looking in fantasy. T. Higgins is now in the circle of trust. Traquan Smith, who had a couple of touchdowns against the Lions on only 4 targets. Now, Michael Thomas is going to be back here, maybe even in week 5. We'll see. Time will tell. But Traquan should be added in leagues where he is available. Other wide receivers: Cole Beasley, Hunter Renfro, Laviska Shenault, Scott Miller, for as long as Chris Godwin's going to be out. And then David Moore in deeper leagues, because Russ is cooking and all his wide receivers are benefiting at this point. So, depending on how big your league is, how competitive your league is, some or all of those guys could be available. None of those players is owned in more than 40% of ESPN leagues right now.
All right. How about the tight end picture here?
Dalton Schultz was one of my starts for week 4, and he played very well. 8 targets, 4 catches, a touchdown, over 17 points against the Browns. He's got 24 targets in the last 3 weeks. 24. The Cowboys are throwing it a ton. If you have Dak Prescott, you're loving things right now. Even if you're a Cowboys fan, I guess, right? Because if the Cowboys can't win games, at least Dak is loading up, man, the fantasy stat sheets. He's been ridiculous. It's the perfect storm of a great offense and a bad defense. I didn't want to use a stronger term there, although I kind of feel like that. Mo Alie-Cox, only 2 targets, but he did have a touchdown. He's averaged nearly 13 fantasy points in the last 3 games. The target share is really wicked low, so he's touchdown dependent, but he's been pretty good the last 3 weeks. Drew Sample, if you're desperate, he had 5 targets. Joe Burrow likes to throw the football to his tight ends, but tight end also getting very, very thin on the waiver wire right now.
And any quarterbacks out there to look at?
Yeah, Justin Herbert. You know, admittedly, I didn't love him coming out of college. Oregon quarterbacks have not had the best luck in the NFL since like Dan Fouts, but he's looked pretty good. I mean, 20 of 25, 290, 23 points against the Bucs, 20 plus points in 2 of his first 3 NFL games. His next 4 games: Saints, winner. Jets, winner. Dolphins, winner. Jaguars, winner. So that's a hell of a schedule for Herbert over the next 4 weeks. And then Teddy Bridgewater, like Bridgewater's not like a fantasy quarterback, right? He's more of a guy who's going to get 15, 16 points per game. He was very good against the Cardinals. And by the way, the Cardinals were dreadful too. Bridgewater, 26.2 points. Look at his schedule. Next four games. Atlanta, winner. Bears, tough. Saints, winner. And then Atlanta again, winner. So Bridgewater could be, with the bye weeks here, he could end up being a nice streamer in fantasy leagues and DFS for sure. Some other guys who should be owned but probably aren't. Ryan Fitzpatrick, 20-plus points in three straight games. And then Gardner Minshew, he's available in about 50% of leagues on ESPN. Another 20-point performance this one against the Bengals.
And you promised me a kicker this week. Give me a kicker.
They don't get enough respect. And in most fantasy leagues, you start a damn kicker, and most people will be like looking at names. So if the name is big, I'll start him. Rodrigo Blankenship. All right. I love that name. It's almost like
so good.
The first half of his last name is a swear. So you're like Rodrigo Blankenship. 13 points against the Raiders. He's got 12 field goal conversions on the year. He's ridiculously accurate. He has scored 10 plus points in three straight games. And the Colts offense is conducive to kickers getting a ton of opportunities because they don't score a ton of touchdowns. They're a run-based offense, and they're giving this kid all kinds of opportunities. He also wears the cool goggles. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, he's I'm a fan. So Rodrigo freaking Blankenship, pick him up and start him if you need a kicker.
I love it, man. If there was ever a kicker to be excited about, it is Rodrigo
That's
Blankenship.
Right. And in fact, I feel like people who pick him up should have to wear the goggles on Sundays like he does, you know. And he wears them, like, with the helmet over it. He's the man. I love it.
All right, Fabs, always a pleasure. You will be back next Monday on our show, but you're here all the time during the week, so subscribe to the SI Fantasy Podcast. Catch him on si.com/fantasy. You get out of here now. Connor Orr, you come back in. We still have more Sunday action to talk about. So we got the winless Vikings visiting the winless Texans, and now the Vikings are no longer winless. And it was a very Mike Zimmer sort of game flow here. A ton of time of possession here for the Vikings, lots of rushing attempts, and the defense holds on. Harrison Smith got tossed in this one for a helmet-to-helmet hit. And by the way, I know Mike Zimmer was steamed. I know some Vikings fans were steamed, but that is, if you ear hole a guy with the crown of your helmet, even if it's sort of a like, oh, yeah, he didn't know the guy was going to be dipping his head. Harrison Smith's not a dirty player by any means, but if you ear hole a guy with the crown of your helmet, you are going to get ejected this year. That's the rule now. That's how it's going to work. But let's talk about this Texans team. The receivers, lots of speed. They just don't get a lot of separation. And quite frankly, sometimes when they do get separation, Deshaun Watson is just holding on to the ball because he doesn't trust his guys out there is what it feels like right now. And they did mount some offense late, and they did almost come all the way back and force overtime, but it's things just aren't really getting better in Houston right now.
It brought back memories of being a beat writer for the Jets and the Giants in the 2010 through 2014 years, where there was a lot of meagerness going on, right? And what you do if you're a beat writer, your first instinct when the team is 0-4 is to call up the members of the 1992 San Diego Chargers, who are the only 0-4 team ever in modern NFL history to reach the playoffs. I went to that well so many times that once when the Giants started the year 0-4, I went to go open my mouth to ask Tom Coughlin a question, and he said, I know, the 1992 San Diego Chargers. So my point there is that the Texans were one of six teams in 2018 to start 0-3 and make the playoffs. They're not making the playoffs this year, and I think everything is a disaster, to the point where I brought this up in a column that I wrote today, is that Laremy Tunsil is a top five left tackle. I think that's for sure true, and it was true last year. He was good enough on his own to, if you like PFF rankings, which I do, the Texans were the worst offensive line in football in 2018, and they were the 20th best in 2019. So single-handedly, he brought that average up so much so. But through 4 weeks, Deshaun Watson's pressure rate is higher than it's been since before the Laremy Tunsil trade. So if your team if Deshaun Watson's still getting crushed or still seeing a lot of pressure, and you traded all of your assets for one piece of this puzzle and it's not making a difference across the board, like I think all of a sudden his little house of cards that he's constructed is going to come tumbling down. Like a lot of the moves that he's made, Bill O'Brien the GM, in desperation to help Bill O'Brien the coach, I mean, it, you know, I kind of broke it all down, it's looking pretty meager. You know, this is not a good looking roster. And yes, the schedule sucks, but you knew that going in. You knew that, you didn't know the order necessarily, but you knew you were going to have to play all these teams.
Yeah, it's there's a lack of efficiency to the moves they've made. I mean, Laremy Tunsil's a good player, and everyone should want him, but it becomes a question of how much are you going to pay for him? And boy, they paid a whole lot, and
if you're the Miami Dolphins, how hard are you celebrating right now? Like, I mean, it's unbelievable. You're going to have a decently high first round draft pick of your own, and then possibly like the number three pick in the NFL draft.
Do you take Trevor Lawrence? Is the Tua era over in Miami?
Oh,
that's what we get to talk about all offseason. As soon as Tua gets out there week 10, and if he does not immediately light the world on fire.
That's the thing, though. There's, you know, and this is a discussion for another day, but I'll just leave it at this. There's going to be a team that does not need him that is going to trip into him. At this point, like, if you're looking at the state of play, like, unless the Chicago Bears totally tank, you know, and lose the remainder of their games or something like that, like, the Panthers aren't going to sit at the number one pick, and that's a team that could obviously use a quarterback. You know, none of the bridge teams like the Saints or the Buccaneers or the Falcons are going to trip that far, I don't think. And you're going to get either the Jets, the Giants, the Texans, like one of these teams that have a franchise quarterback, maybe even the Dolphins, that are going to have to choose between keeping their guy and drafting the best prospect we've seen since Andrew Luck. It's pretty interesting.
Let's go to Las Vegas. How about the Bills? 4-0 Buffalo Bills. Josh Allen again. He's not missing downfield. Any questions about the biggest weakness in his game have suddenly been answered with near perfection as far as his downfield throwing goes. And look, it's kind of made up for the fact. If you're a Bills fan, I think the thing you worry about right now is the fact that the pass rush, which already wasn't great, has really dried up the last 2 weeks, or I should say like the last six quarters of football at this point. And I thought the points they gave up against the Rams was a lot of Jared Goff just playing really, really well. I thought that second half in Buffalo was as good as Jared Goff has ever played. But they just didn't really have it going in Las Vegas defensively. The Raiders did move the ball. You wonder if the pass defense is going to be a little bit susceptible, but boy, it's Josh Allen. Josh Allen's just carrying this thing right now.
Yeah, who would have thought we'd be saying that right now? And this is starting to turn into one of those classic 2020 things where, at least this is a successful thing, but where you look around and you're like, this can't keep going, can it? Like, things can't keep going like this. But with the Bills, I do think that we're starting to see some sustainability, you know? And this is a team that might not bottom out and level out like everybody keeps thinking they will, which is, man, it's fascinating. I mean, he's a top-tier player right now. And shout out to Bills fan Sam Wagner, who found my direct messages after I picked the Bills to start the season 7-9, and he reaches out to me two or three times a week just to ask me how I'm still employed. The short answer is I don't know, Sam, but you know, it's good for you. I hope that you and the rest of Bills Mafia are enjoying this right now.
It's human resources is sort of a drop in the ball there. I mean, I keep on flagging Connor for you know, that 7-9 prediction, and it's just unforgivable at this point. No, I will say, so Josh Allen and whatever, we're going to talk about Josh Allen a million times between now and I don't know, his 12th MVP award. But Josh Allen, look, I think the Cam Newton comparison has always been spot on going back to Wyoming. He just ran a different kind of offense in college than Cam did. He is streaky. Cam is streaky. Josh Allen is streaky. I think you're going to see some bad streaks. I think you're going to see some games where he leaves, 8 to 10 throws on the field, and that's just sort of the way it's going to end up being with him. However, I will say, Stephon Diggs is a difference maker. Stephon Diggs was absolutely just a, I mean, he was the perfect addition to this offense. You know, a guy like John Brown, is his speed, Cole Beasley, his ability to separate underneath. He has a collection of weapons that Cam never had in Carolina. So it's almost like you're perhaps we're going to see over the next couple of years what Cam could have been sustained over a 4 or 5 year run had the Panthers provided him with the type of offense that the Bills have provided Josh Allen with. And, you know, you get to max out your guy, and that's a nice thing.
The Bills are very, very lucky that I think that owners, in large part, don't know how to run football franchises, and that they were able to hang on to Brian Daboll for another year. Like, I think that if anybody was tracking this sort of thing, like all these owners claim to have short lists of coaches and that they're constantly studying this stuff, when in reality they just punt and hand it off to some search firm at the last minute because they don't care. But, you know, if anybody was really looking at what Josh Allen came out as and in the actual day-to-day work that was put into bringing him to this point and the understanding of him as a player and how that reflects the scheme, like, there would be no way he would still have his offensive coordinator right now, and I think it would be a different story. But I think it's a really interesting and fortunate that he was able to kind of have that stability at the position when a lot of these other guys have not been that lucky.
The other wild thing about Daboll is he has worked for Belichick and Saban, so you'd think that alone,
I know,
would very much have him on people's radar.
Got Joe Judge hired from special teams, which is like almost impossible to do. And I know he also coached wide receivers, and he's a good head coach. But like, yeah, the Belichick Saban thing was like next to being Sean McVay's valet in 2018. That was about the hottest thing that you could put on your resume.
According to Wikipedia, Matt Patricia used to also work with Bill Belichick. His Lions, little spark of optimism after they go down to Arizona and pull off the upset last week. This defense was it was helpless against the Michael Thomas-less and Jared Cook-less Saints. Drew Brees just sort of feasted on them. A lot of crossers. It's a team with no pass rush, and it's a team that really struggles to cover man-to-man. I don't know what the answer ends up being here with this Lions defense. And Patricia taking a lot of heat across the Twitterverse on Monday morning because he was asked about, you know, why are you still the guy here? And he sort of said, there are a lot of things that need fixing. I should have pulled up the exact quote, but, he was asked and he said, you know, there are a lot of things that needed fixing when I got here. And people sort of will point out that, you know, they had winning records under Jim Caldwell pretty consistently. I do allow for the fact that you can look at a team like that and say, like, you know, hey, we got to get to the next level, and that's going to take a bit of a step back. Matt Patricia seems to he had a lot of guys who didn't buy into his system early on, and therefore you want to bring in the guys that will buy into your system. But you've had a chance to do that over the last 3 years here, and you know you moved on from a Quandre Diggs for pennies on the dollar. You moved on from Darius Slay, and you got your guys in the secondary, and it's still, you know, maybe it clicks in the second half of the year, but right now it is definitively not.
Yeah, I don't think that he deserves to have another offseason where he essentially just signs all the guys that Bill Belichick wants to get rid of again and then convinces himself that this is going to get fixed. This is broken, and like we were talking about a little bit with Houston, and perhaps even worse because they have a franchise quarterback that's getting up there in years, like, this is a roster that's going to be in really bad shape for whoever gets the job after this too, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's theoretically like a poor man's effort at reconstructing that amoebic Patriots defense, but it's not working, and, you know, no other coach can really do that outside of Bill Belichick and put something together. like that. Maybe Don Martindale in Baltimore, but and maybe that's who you need to go hire. I don't know, but it's one of those things where you know, this roster is going to be in bad shape for a little while, and you know, I think that you know, every coach leans on that, right? That, oh, well, it needed so much fixing. I mean, look what the narrative has been in New York ever since Adam Gase has gotten there. But at some point, you have to fix it. Like, you don't get 5 years to do this anymore unless you're John Gruden.
Let's go down to Carolina. Matt Rhule's Panthers go to 2-2. Matt Rhule putting in the his petition for NFL Coach of the Year this year. 2-2, both wins coming without Christian McCaffrey. You're seeing an efficient offense. You're seeing Teddy Bridgewater do occasional things that are very un-Teddy Bridgewater-like, both good and bad. He had a long scramble for a TD. I think it was like his first TD in like a rushing TD, I should say, in 5 years. He's making some kind of reckless throws as well, which is not what we're used to seeing do, but he got away with them against Arizona on Sunday. But they're making it work in Carolina, and Matt Rhule deserves a lot of credit for that.
Definitely. And just the Teddy Bridgewater looks like, and I guess you could credit the Saints for that as well and sort of his time there, but Teddy Bridgewater looks like a good NFL quarterback. I mean, he looks like an Alex Smith plus. Like you said, there's probably a little bit more of a variance in the bad throws, the bad decision throws, but not to the point where, you know, I would put him anywhere near like destructive, you know, and anything like that.
And if anything, he needed a little touch of that anyway.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
His game. I mean, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's nice to see when you put a ball into a defender's hands, but it's kind of like, all right, well, let's open this thing up a little bit. Let's take some chances.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think that they've done a great job with him to the point where, I mean, we joked about this, but they were the one logical fit for Trevor Lawrence, and they've taken themselves completely out of the race there. But if I'm a Panthers fan, I'm okay with Teddy Bridgewater being my quarterback for the next 3 years. You know, you sign him through the life of that deal, and we probably get to see what he would have evolved into in Minnesota had he not had that horrific knee injury. So I think we're finally getting to get a fuller look at him, and we're also getting kind of a neat picture of what Joe Brady's idea for this team is in the future, and that's a team that I think is definitely going to be a pain in the butt, I think, for teams throughout the year, and Arizona found that out this weekend.
I will, my gut feeling is I will regret saying this, but and that Cliff Kingsbury will get this figured out, but I hate this Cardinals offense right now. I hate it. It's quick strike or it's Kyler scrambling. They were 5.5 yards per reception in Carolina. Per reception. Ooh. I mean, that's unreal for this day and age. And look, they added DeAndre Hopkins. They get a world-class receiver, and the issue last year with Kyler was intermediate and deep intermediate levels. He just wasn't very good at those levels, and quite frankly, he was being asked to make a lot of difficult throws to those levels. They didn't have receivers who were separating. You do kind of wonder if vision stuff comes in with him, because you know, he is so undersized. But I mean, it is quarter way through the season. It's not getting better as far as that goes. And it's a limited offense right now. And Kyler will make plays some weeks, but that's not the kind of thing you can bank on. You can't say like, well, at some point Kyler's going to scramble for 60 yards and we'll be all right. You can't do that. You got to come up with something.
Yeah, you can't run an offense, especially, you know, and I haven't looked. I knew what their percentage of four wide usage was last year and how it was probably about 28% higher than any other team in the NFL.
Yep.
I'm assuming that it's probably close to that this year too, but you can't run that kind of offense and attempt 31 balls a day, and that's on the low end, and only throw for 133 yards. Like, it's not the way that works. And you need to mix it up. You need to get the ball downfield. I think Hopkins wasn't able to get, didn't even have a target in the first quarter of this game, if I'm not mistaken. I think it took him a while to get involved there. So, yeah, I don't know. And they have all the components of it, which just doesn't make sense. I mean, your third wide receiver is Christian Kirk, where, you know, if, you know, the state of the wide receiver around the NFL, if you put him on 10 or 12 teams, he would probably be close to their number one or number two. Like, you have talent layered throughout the roster there, and I'm just not sure why it's not taking as well as it should be.
Yeah, well, like I said, Cliff Kingsbury has a chance to figure it out here. That's the guy that Steve Keim wanted to bring in to run this program, and he probably will, and I'll sound stupid, but right now I just hate it. let's go out to L.A., where the Giants were game in this game. That's a terrible turn of phrase, but I'll stick with it. They were right there. This was an absolute dogfight here. The Giants hung around throughout this one. Rams opened the game with a pretty Ram-like scoring drive, and it was just kind of like, all right, well, here we go. This game's going to be 41-7. And the Rams did nothing after that. They had 175 yards of offense over their nine drives after the opening drive, and that was with a 55-yard Cooper Kupp TD folded in there. So off day for the Rams, a little bit worrisome there, but the Giants just seem uninterested in scoring points. And you got to do something here. You got to come up with something new.
Yeah. I would say that that's a difficult prospect when you've hired Jason Garrett as your offensive coordinator, who hasn't really come up with anything new since 2004, when he was the hot coaching name on the market. And I think it's just, you know, this offense is just, it lacks any sort of panache. Like there is just nothing about it that differentiates it from the rest of the NFL. And I will say that Daniel Jones is hanging in there. I do think he's playing a lot better than he's been given credit for, but if you know he's making really good throws. And the drive ending interception at the end of the game when they were down 8 points yesterday was a great play, right? I mean, the Rams made some great play defensive plays yesterday, and of course there's some bad turnovers too, but this offense is just so uninteresting, and it's just incredible. You know, I don't know what else to say about it. I will say the one nice thing that's going for the Giants that we did see yesterday is that defensive line is very good. You know, is it worth it? All the resources Dave Gettleman's pulled into getting that, I'm not sure. But I mean, they did play an effective game against the Rams. They did kind of hold them and force them to do some things that were a little bit more uncomfortable. But that said, if you can't bring your offense around and score 21 points in an NFL game, I don't know what you're doing there.
Seahawks get quite the battle in Miami. This was a one possession game pretty much throughout here, and Miami ended up just kicking a bunch of field goals when they got down to scoring range, and that's where this one turned. The one thing I wrote about this on Sunday morning, the Seahawks red zone offense has been just spectacular. At least coming into this game, they were 9 for 9. They actually stretched that to 10 for 10. Not only that, they only had one third down in the red zone. They were scoring so easily. Really good play calling, really creative stuff going on down there. And this one that dried up a little. They had a turnover on downs. Russ actually threw an interception, sort of his first legitimate interception of the year from the 6-yard line. And that's what ends up having the Dolphins kind of hang around in this one. But, you know, look, the Dolphins are not a world-beating offense, but the fact that the Seahawks defense sort of held on without Jamal Adams is, I guess that's a plus at this point.
Yeah, you know, they're just... this is one of those games that, like, I'm not going to lie, if you were able to, like, if you were not in Seattle and you watched this with a great deal of interest, like, good for you. I mean, I was struggling to come up with things to watch in the 4 p.m. hour yesterday. Was this a 4 p.m. or a 1? That was a 1.
This was a 1, yeah.
Yeah, I was, you know, the back end of that 1 p.m. schedule and the 4 p.m. schedule, I was struggling. And I do watch every game every week. This is on my list, but, like, holy smokes. I mean, this was, if you gutted this thing out without a Seattle fandom interest or, you know, a very deep fantasy football rooting interest, good for you. I mean, there were some just overtly boring games this weekend, and from the beginning, this was just kind of one of those weeks, but man, this was good for you if you watched this entire thing.
Joe Burrow gets his first career win here. A lot of Joe Burrow, a lot of Joe Mixon in this one. Offensive line holds up. I don't know if that Jaguars front four is really challenging teams that much, but this was another step forward for the Bengals here, so good on them.
I think we're going to look back at the Jaguars' win over the Colts as one of the most insane things that happened in this 2020 season. They have not been playing as well. Gardner Minshew continues to play really well, which is really interesting for them moving forward. But yeah, good for Joe Burrow. I think we're starting to see a little bit of what the Bengals saw, not only in him, but in Zach Taylor too. I think he's kind of coming into his own as a little bit, and it doesn't have the pressure of, you know, that kind of sinking ship. He can kind of start building on something there. So yeah, I think the Bengals are looking good.
It was nice. It was that taste of if the Bengals ever get right on the offensive line, here's what you're going to see going forward. So nice day for them. And the Ravens kind of get right. The offense still doesn't look like it's fully clicking like it was a year ago. And you know, the absence of Marshall Yanda is probably going to haunt them throughout the year. But the Ravens get a pretty easy win against football team in the nation's capital. The other story in this game, Dwayne Haskins was kind of on call going into this one. And was he going to get bench mid-game? So yeah, he played well enough to keep his job in this one. He continues to sprinkle in a couple of really nice big throws. Everyone's sort of getting on him for this fourth and goal throw he made well short of the goal line. That just it was a bad decision, but it wasn't the kind of thing that you look at and say, like, boy, you know, he's not seeing the field or something like that. He made a boneheaded decision, and that just kind of is how it goes.
Do you think that Ron Rivera just gives him the season so he can show fans, like, okay, this is the sample size. Now may I go out and get somebody that I like a little bit more? And this isn't an indictment on Haskins, but Rivera wasn't sold on him in the first place, right?
Yep.
I mean, you know, he was talking about potentially taking a quarterback at number two. You know, he signed Kyle Allen and wouldn't immediately count him out of the quarterback competition this offseason. And so I think that, you know, it might be one of those things where it's like, okay, well, we're going to give him the entire year. We're going to pour all the resources in. He has a very good offensive coordinator, and we're going to just let that speak for itself.
I will take the very Pollyannish look and just say, I do think Rivera was very open to give him a shot. I mean, Dwayne Haskins has the physical traits that you look for in a starting quarterback here, and just saying, okay, let's see what we have this year. And I do think it was in that Cleveland loss, I think that sunk to a level where you were legitimately going to have a difficult time basically facing the locker room if you continue to run him out there when he's playing like that. But like I said, he was certainly above that level against a really good Ravens defense, and he's going to make mistakes, and you know, you try and lessen those mistakes week in, week out, and you know, this is all right for them.
Yeah, it's fine. It's good. For once, they're not the epitome of dysfunction as they once were. Good for you.
That's epitome of dysfunction is one of my favorite Dan Snyder solo albums. Connor Orr, you have your own podcast feed now. Well, you share it with Jenny Vrentis. I mean, you know, it's, if anything, it's Jenny Vrentis and Connor Orr.
Jenny is the landlord. I'm renting. So
you guys, the Weekside Podcast has its own feed. Subscribe to it now. I always like when you join me on the show, and I'm just going to make you keep doing it for the first part of the season here.
Can I get credit, by the way, for I'm in my soon to be second child's bedroom, and because everywhere else is just a noise explosion in the house right now. But I did this entire podcast standing up, the entire thing.
You did. I wasn't going to bring it up. You were, I felt like you were fading a little bit late.
Yeah.
But I was like, I don't know, can I get through my Dwayne Haskins rant at this point? But
I was at mile 26 there, you know, but but I got through, and now it's time to collapse and make myself some pancakes.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Connor Orr and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire line of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast, the MMQB Weekside Podcast, and the MMQB Albert Breer Show. They are all for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, do us a favor and leave ratings, leave reviews. It really does help other people find the show, which are also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.